Okay, welcome everybody. Welcome to the second talk of the session. And today's talk will be on absolute return strategies. And we'll be looking at it from with profits fund perspective and also with pensions. First of all, Gareth Derbyshire will be talking about with profits from a pensions perspective. Gareth is a managing director in the pensions advisory group at Lehman Brothers. He joined Lehman in 2006 and has over 20 years of experience in the UK pensions industry, with 11 years at investment banks. He's responsible for Lehman's UK pensions coverage and advises on efficient funding of pension liabilities and risk management. Gareth is a fellow of the Institute of Actuaries, a member of the NAPF Investment Council, and chairs the NAPF Working Group on Financial Instruments. And then we have Brian Fleming, who's going to talk to us about absolute return strategies in the context of with-profit funds. After Brian studied maths and physics at Heriot-Watt University, he went on to obtain a PhD in nonlinear time series analysis. Brian joined Standard Life Investments in 2002 on the risk management desk before moving to the multi-asset investing team in 2004, where he was responsible for the technical development of Standard Life's LDI products. He's currently the head of multi-asset risk and structuring, and Brian is also a CFA charter holder. Okay, so without further ado, I'll hand you over to Gareth.
Thanks, Zoe. Hi, everyone. So I'm doing the pension stuff, and here's my agenda. So firstly, I'm going to give you a bit of a history recap on why absolute return strategies and why now. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the relationship or the split between beta and alpha, and the fact that in the last 5 to 10 years, really, pension funds have begun to think about that issue, and more recently have, if anything, started to move a little less in terms of beta, and to reduce the beta exposure and gain a little bit more alpha. And then thirdly, we'll talk about some sample asset allocations and how one might do things slightly better than many are doing them now. So first of all, the history lesson. And I'm going to pick on 2 points of history, first of all. The first one is 1990, or any point prior to that, and the second one is 2005-ish. So think back to 1990 or earlier. And those of you who are familiar with pension fund liability valuations, other than in the exams, will remember that liability bases were fairly static then. I can remember back to 1990, typically a basis might be something like 975, which would be a 9% discount rate, 7% salary escalation, 5% pension increases reflecting inflation. In fact, if you go back beyond that, and I still remember doing liability valuations in the late 80s, there was one particular partner at the firm in which I worked, whereas that was a fairly standard basis, 975, he would insist on all his bases being 753, which looked ridiculous where, you know, even in a non-market-oriented world, looked fairly ridiculous given where market levels were and where inflation was and so on. But as he used to frequently point out, it didn't really matter, because what mattered was the gaps between the assumptions. And 975, so a discount rate which is 2% over salaries and 4% inflation, was actually very similar to a 753 basis. So all of that is to say that back in the 1990s and earlier, liability bases were such that the liabilities really didn't move around an awful lot. And your funding position improved if the real return you achieved on the assets over time was higher than the assumptions. So in that world of fairly static liabilities, you'd think that absolute return strategies would be fairly attractive if they'd been recognised. The reality was there weren't too many of them around. There were some hedge funds around then, although none of us had actually heard of them. But there weren't really very many. And the other factor was that equity volatility itself was quite commonly disguised by asset valuation methods. So looking at current levels of dividend income and discounting those back at the discount rate in the liability valuation, allowing for some level of dividend growth. So absolute return strategies would have been attractive, but no one was quite there yet. Now let's move forward to 2005-ish, and it could equally well be 2004 or 2003. A world where IAS 19 is very much in place, IAS 19 and FRS 17, where funding bases are moving increasingly to a mark-to-market basis. Liabilities are now widely agreed and understood to be bond-like and volatile. LDI hedging can take out much of that volatility, but it was really the early days of LDI. I can think of one fairly large insurer that had de-risked all the liabilities in 2003. The Boots transaction moving to 100% bonds was somewhat beyond that, before that, so I can't remember exactly. I'm guessing about 2001, but I may be out by a year or two either side. But LDI, as we know it today, was relatively unusual. So the focus was on asset performance needing to outperform these volatile liabilities. And in that world, you might say absolute return strategies are of very little help at all. Why do you need something that's going to be focused on little volatility when you've got the liabilities moving around all over the place? So in 2005-ish, in the absence of LDI, then absolute return strategies probably don't have that much of a role to play, except as a diversifier from the more traditional assets. And what's happened since then? Well, I guess I've kind of given you the hints of that already, which is LDI has become mainstream. Liabilities are marked to market, of course, but many pension funds now hedge back that liability risk using interest rate and inflation swaps or other techniques, so that you do effectively have a liability stream that looks a lot more like LIBOR. And, of course, against the LIBOR benchmark, then absolute return strategies come into play very much more. And even for those funds that have not adopted the LDI approach, and there are plenty of them, and we'll come back to that a little later, then you can still make the diversification argument. It probably argues a smaller allocation to absolute return strategies, but there still is a fairly robust argument there. I'll say a word or two about the development of LDI. So this is a fairly typical risk-return chart with return on the vertical axis and risk on the horizontal one. And there's three efficient frontiers, and this is all really quite simple stuff. The frontier over on the right-hand side is meant to indicate what you might have got from a traditional asset allocation. This chart does have a slight handicap in that it's got a white background and it's got some white lines on it, clearly, which you can't see at all. But where those arrows are pointing to, there are supposed to be lines going from the right, the frontier on the right, heading directly left, heading directly left again, and then going up. I think it's fairly obvious where they should be. And what this is meant to represent is that the one on the right is a traditional efficient frontier for a traditional asset allocation. And then what we call first generation LDI is really the process of taking out a lot of the risk in the liability. So moving from that frontier to the red one, the point on there. So lower risk, similar levels of return, because all you've done is de-risk the liabilities. And the world has really moved on a little from there to focus more on what we might call second generation LDI, which is risk management of the assets as well as the liabilities, which would take you over to the grey dots in the middle there, and then the more efficient creation of alpha, which hopefully takes you to a higher point onto a more efficient frontier. What are the biggest risks to pension funds? Well, there are a number of ways that you can decompose or attribute the risk, but they come down to largely the same thing, which is this chart at the bottom. And I say there are a couple of different ways you can do it. But basically, for the vast majority of funds who haven't specifically addressed this, it's a combination of two things. One is risk embedded in the liabilities, which is real rates and nominal rates, or nominal rates and inflation, depending on how you want to express it. And the second one is equity markets beta. Usually in that order, the combination of the first two dominates the equity market risk. And the reasons for that, for the interest rate and inflation risk being so large, are partly because to the extent that pension funds hold bonds, they don't hold very much in bonds historically, or certainly not enough to substantially reduce that risk. And secondly, when they do, they tend to be the wrong kinds of bonds, so short compared to the duration of the liabilities. And of course, equities are not a good match for liabilities anyway. They're there to add value, so they represent a significant amount of risk. But in particular, the risk you get from smaller allocations, very small, property we've included here, we haven't included credit, so corporate bonds and so on, But look at how small manager alpha is. And this is based on a portfolio or a pension fund with fairly typical manager guidelines. So I think for this one, it was part passive, part active. But the active portfolios were reasonably aggressive. But you find that the total amount of the risk budget being allocated to active managers is really very modest. You get a diversification pickup from that because not all these things move in line, and you get the total risk on the end there. So one thing that certainly does make sense to focus on is increasing the degree of manager alpha that you're targeting and allocating a higher risk budget to that, assuming that you believe that you can find sources of alpha. That's a given. If you can't, then you shouldn't be looking at it at all. That would also be a more diversified form of risk budget. But there is a caveat to that, which is that we all know, and it's clear when you look at things like private equity fees, hedge fund manager fees, alpha is considerably more expensive than beta. You can get equity market exposure for, you know, less than 10 basis points from the passive managers. So what is an absolute return strategy? What do we mean by it? It's a bit like LDI, actually. It's not really that very well specified, but it's different things to different people. But generally, I'm going to define it as something that's less beta-oriented and more alpha-oriented. In particular, strategies as a benchmark against LIBOR fit quite well into that definition. So things like hedge funds, long-short products in particular, especially where they're market neutral. I think some capital guarantee structures, so for instance, CPPI structures around credit or capital guarantee commodities, two examples, it seems fairly logical to define those as absolute return oriented. You could define, I think, some short duration structured credit, CDOs or something like that, if anyone lets me use such a dirty word nowadays, but certainly something short duration there would count, I think, as absolute return. And some of the other alternative ideas, such as infrastructure, timber, and other things, are arguably absolute return oriented. If you really let me stretch the definition, you might let me include some low vol equity ideas, and people do include these type of approaches sometimes as absolute return oriented. I think it's a slight stretch of the definition. But for instance, ideas where you've got cash plus call options on the equity market, certainly there's limited downside, and they arguably fit into the absolute return bucket. Now, I'm not a big fan of looking at putting up slides, lots of slides, talking about different asset allocations, their characteristics, when it's also assumption-driven, but I'm going to do it anyway, just to give you an example of how people might move slightly differently. So this starts off with a not untypical pension fund asset allocation. You can see it's got about 50%, it's got exactly 50% in equities. It's got 45% in bonds, being a mixture of nominal gilts, linkers, and corporate stuff, whether it's corporate bonds or synthetic credit or what. And a small allocation of 5% to hedge fund of funds. And you can see some expected return assumptions down the right-hand side. And I'm not going to debate those. We don't have time, and everyone has their own opinion. But there are some broad characteristics of this mix for this pension fund down the right-hand side. So we project that in 10 years' time, the funding position might be 92%. That's the mean of the distribution. The downside risk in terms of two standard deviations is given as 45%. So that's the worst case outcome in one sense. The one-year VAR number is £72 million. And the probability of hitting a funding target of, say, 105% is not insignificant, but fairly limited, 29%. The reason we picked 105% was just to build in some margin for mortality reserve, basically, so mortality improvements above and beyond the improvements that are already factored into the underlying assumptions. So that's not an untypical or an atypical pension fund allocation and set of circumstances. Here's one thing you can do, a fairly classical de-risking. This one is 10% equities and 90% bonds. And on the bonds that are held, an overlay has been applied to make sure that the duration and the inflation exposure of those is the same as the liabilities. There's still 10% equities being held against long-duration inflation-linked liabilities, but the interest rate and inflation risk on those liabilities covered by these assets has been hedged out. Low equity oriented, and it's probably no surprise that the projected funding position going forward is significantly lower, 78%. There's not much downside though, that's good news. And the VAR number likewise falls very significantly. The chance of becoming fully funded or fully funded with a small surplus is just about zero though, because you simply haven't got the return seeking assets in here. And if we go back to the position, let's say a year or two ago, where many funds were funded to the 70, 80 or 90% funding level on whatever basis, certainly on accounting bases, then this is the issue that many have faced, which is if they de-risk in this kind of way, it becomes very difficult to achieve full funding without putting in a whole load of money to get there. So here's a slightly more sophisticated solution. We've still got 50% in equities, although magically it's been transposed to the bottom of the column this time instead of at the top, but it's been called risk-adjusted equity. And I should explain the kinds of things that we're thinking of there. It could be, it's a low-vol form of equity. It could be some form of equity that has put options associated with it. It could be something that tries to exploit the fact that equities tend to be more volatile in falling markets than in rising markets. There's a directional link there. So something that tries to reduce volatility using that. It could be that something that tries better benchmarking. There are inherent biases in most of the equity benchmarks out there. You know, quite often they're dominated by a relatively small handful of stocks. There are more, arguably better benchmarks that one can use rather than traditional market cap benchmarks. But something that's a risk-adjusted equity portfolio, whatever that means. We've got 45% again in bonds, where the liability risk has been hedged out on those bonds, and 5% in fund of funds. And not surprisingly, the funding ratio projected is pretty much the same as in the first scenario, because we haven't really changed the underlying asset allocation significantly. So that's 93%. The downside risk is quite a lot better. It can get down as low as 59. In the first one, it was 45. The VAR number has gone down to 51%. And the chance of hitting your 105% funding target is pretty much unchanged. It's 27%. So just from a risk management point of view, you know, there's nothing really radical being done here. But that's something that clearly better manages risk than the initial allocation that we put up. But arguably one can do a little better than that too. So this is how one might put it all together. Step one, you put on an LDI hedge across all the liabilities, not just those liabilities being matched by bonds. LDI hedge across all the liabilities. You reduce some of the focus on the equity market beta, and you look for diversified sources of alpha. And maybe you end up with something like this, which is 30% equity, 30 bonds, 10 property, and 30 alternatives. And within the equity, it's 15% traditional kind of equity, 15% this low vol that I described before. Within the bonds, this is the wonders of investment banking. We managed to get four lots of 10% to add up to 30%. So come to investment banks, you always get 10% more for your money or something. I think that the final 10% after the slash isn't meant to be there, but you've got 30% in a combination of bonds, including credit, trying to add a bit more return, which is arguably now is a reasonable time to be doing that as well, given what's happened to credit spreads. 10% in property and 30% in a diversified set of alternatives, as you see there. And not too surprisingly, given what I've been saying, then the characteristics of this portfolio improve on the right-hand side, both in terms of the projected funding position and also a fairly efficient risk budget, so a fairly low downside risk. And whether you agree with those assumptions, whether you like those asset classes or not, it's the general idea which is important here, which is better diversification, less in beta, more in alpha, and a proper focus on risk management. And that's the route that some pension funds are going in, but only some. What is happening in practice? Well, we're seeing gradually falling equity allocations, but it's really quite slow. If you go back to the mid-90s, the average pension fund allocation was of the order of 85%, would you believe? But if you go back 3 or 4 years, it's been in the low 60s, and it's gradually coming down, but at really a fairly slow rate to somewhere just north of 55 currently. There is certainly a greater use of LDI strategies. Nick Horsfall of Watson Wyatt was quoted recently as estimating that 35 billion of inflation swaps have been done by UK pension funds. And that's quite a large number. But set it against round about £1 trillion of defined benefit liabilities. You can see it's actually quite a small number in terms of progress to date. There is certainly diversification into alternatives and into a wider range of alternatives. And I do think that maybe hedge funds have reached a tipping point in terms of how pension funds perceive them. I think everyone here probably realises there's a lot of herd behaviour in pension fund, or herd mentality in pension fund behaviour. And that's been exhibited in many ways. But the flow into alternative assets is one of those. And I think hedge funds are at the point where they're going to continue to receive large allocations. You might argue it's exactly the wrong time, and it wouldn't be the first time, but I think that's the direction we're still moving in. The slow pace, I think, is a function of market levels to some extent, and a fairly poor governance structure that many pension funds have. In terms of market levels, there is resistance to LDI, so locking into the long end of the curve, especially when the 50-year index-linked gilt yield is less than 0.7%. When I last looked middle of yesterday, it was hovering around 0.6%. And at the same time, something I alluded to earlier, there is some reluctance to de-risk equities, to reduce the equity allocation when funding levels are relatively poor and you still need to invest your way out of the deficit to some extent. So the shift is slower than many media reports would have you believe, but it is undoubtedly there. So to conclude, absolute return strategies, I think, clearly fit better in an LDI world than before, when liabilities were, well, and they still are moving all over the place, but when that liability risk wasn't being hedged. There is something of a trend away from beta towards alpha, which makes sense, but beta is still cheaper and has a significant role to play, and there is a fundamental question of whether you believe you can find managers who will add value in whatever area. The diversification into a broader range of alternatives we discussed and will be ongoing. And there is a trade-off between investment efficiency and complexity. You know, I mentioned the relatively weak governance structure that many pension funds have. I think it's safe to say that most smaller funds are unlikely to go all the way or even a significant part of the way down this route. But amongst the larger funds and the medium-sized funds, the trends that we've seen, I think, will continue. And that's me as far as pensions goes.
Thanks, Gareth. Here we go. Okay, thank you. Just for a start off, I need to make a couple of confessions, I suppose. This talk was actually given last year by Ewan Monroe, who heads up the multi-asset desk. Effectively, this represents his views of absolute returns in the context of with-profits, not specifically views of Standard Life or Standard Life investments. Second confession is, in fact, that I'm not an actuary. So it's with some slight amusement and probably apprehension that I'm standing here talking about absolute returns for with-profit funds. And given my experience, I'm probably in a better position to talk about LDI funds and absolute return for pensions. But we'll see how we get on. So absolute return for with-profit funds, what's new? As far as we can see, with-profit funds have always really had an absolute return objective, although it may not have been explicitly stated. With-profit funds were largely put together to pay off people's mortgages. So implicitly, the target was some kind of internal rate of return, effectively a mortgage rate. Given that absolute return target, the delivery mechanism was really very simple. It was a static allocation to equity market risk. But really, by equity, we're talking about risky assets and actually something even broader than that. So equities, including and additionally, say, property and private equity. That collection of risky assets is your equity backing ratio. And effectively, you just had to allocate to risky assets, sit back, and effectively harvest the equity risk premium over the long term. The equity backing ratio, the risk profile effectively that you'd be willing to take in the fund was really a function of your risk appetite, which you could interpret in terms of your capital adequacy. The considerable short-term volatility that comes from equities or these risky assets was tolerated, and additionally smoothing mechanisms were also in place so that in good times the regular bonuses that could be paid were perhaps scaled back to help support the bonuses in times of weaker markets. But effectively the absolute return was expected to emerge over the long term, and all of these volatility issues were effectively tolerated. But what has changed? Well, we've seen demutualisations over the last few years, including Standard Life. So now there are shareholders as well as policyholders involved, and those shareholders have to think about capital support for guarantees for these types of funds. So there's a new vested interest in how these funds are run that's beyond policyholders. But really it goes beyond that. The answer is the time frame has very much changed. So there's much less appetite for short-term volatility. And with new ICA-type regulations where you have to stress test for a 1 in 200-year event, even if you've actually just seen a 1 in 200-year event, then these regulations are increasingly onerous. So the investment horizon has really collapsed. The risk appetite, the volatility acceptance has really diminished. And so it's not so much that the investment return target has changed, it's actually just that the time horizon has. So the strap line at the bottom, absolute return every month fees, is a bit of an exaggeration. But effectively, we really do need to think about how do you really manage these funds on an absolute return basis, minimising volatility over timescales of perhaps 1, 2, or 3 years. So equity volatility is the issue. So let's just have a quick look at the term structure of equity returns. This data is based on ABN AMRO's returns yearbook, I think they call it. So it's effectively returns for equities and bonds and the relative returns over the last century. So simply we've constructed here the distribution of returns over different time horizons. So effectively we take rolling 1 year windows, rolling 2 year windows and so on and so forth out to longer time horizons to get a feel for the distribution of returns and the volatility thereof. Now looking at longer time horizons, you see the excess return from equities over bonds, the median has been 5%. However, that is the median, there's some variance around that. And you can see that as you go down to shorter timescales, particularly less than 10 years, you're really expecting a lot more volatility around that 5% level. And particularly within the 1 to 3 year bracket, you can see that there are extreme times for equities underperforming bonds. Now, the difficulty is that we do actually like structural beta. It's efficient. The ability, as we've heard, it's cheap. The ability to make a static allocation to it and sit back and earn that risk premium is cheap to do administratively. You don't really have to pay for that at all. But the problem is we now have the volatility to deal with. And so we can ask, what impact does that have on the overall asset allocation for a with-profit fund? Now, a very simplistic way of looking at the asset allocation or how you would come up with an asset allocation for a with-profit fund is given by, say, for example, this efficient frontier. The big decision is allocating between bonds and equity. So what we've done here is taken 30 years of data, I think it's monthly data. And an efficient frontier, I'm sure most of you are familiar, but just to recap it, it's showing the combination of assets of bonds and equities from 100% bonds to 100% equities that gives you the highest level of return for a given level of risk or the lowest level of risk for a fixed level of return. So we're looking at 100% bonds, return of 10.5%. This is all historical though, so we're not necessarily saying that will be the case going forward. What's much more important is the shape of the frontier and the fact that we're observing an equity risk premium for that period of around 3.5%. And choosing the equity backing ratio would really be a case of moving along that frontier, again interpreted probably in terms of capital adequacy, to take the level of risk that you're happy with within that fund. And to get an idea of what happens if you think about shorter timescales, we can actually just chop that period up into 10-year rolling windows and do efficient frontiers again. And what we're representing here by the blue squares is effectively the uncertainty in the start and end points for that efficient frontier. So you can see that using rolling 10-year windows, there's a lot more uncertainty at the equity end of the efficient frontier, and there are also potentially periods, as we've seen in the previous chart, where equity returns can actually be below those of bonds. And if we continue down to the 3-year level, it effectively looks like a bit more of a lottery. The actual expected, well, the return levels there are very similar. The uncertainty is very broad, and there's not such an obvious upward slope from the 100% bonds to the 100% equity end of the spectrum. So really, it very much breaks down. Now, what is the new strategy? But I actually mean, what are we currently doing to deal with these issues? We've very much taken on board the bear market of 2003 that's also impacted pension funds. And the fact is, things haven't really changed very much. We still have a base level of structural market risk in these funds. It's an allocation to UK equity, say, overseas equity and some property and some private equity. But now what are we going to do if markets fall? And it's quite a pertinent question given the bull run we've had in equities for the last few years and the increased amount of volatility that we're starting to see. And effectively, some of the mechanisms that are there to give comfort to the regulator as well as to the company itself are things like dynamic charges for guarantees within the products. We're also seeing companies hedging at the total level, the market exposure that they have, effectively hedging shareholders' exposure to guarantees and so on and so forth. But if you're actually doing that, you do have to think that if on a net basis you're hedging out your market risks, then do you really expect to earn a risk premium over the long term? But the more relevant thing is probably management actions being put in place to do things like, if equity markets fall, then reduce exposure. Because as we say, if you have a 1 in 200 year event, you still have to have enough capital to back another potential 1 in 200 year loss from the equity market, which is really problematic, and effectively is. Well, actually, I'll come on to CPPI in a moment. But effectively, these management actions are effectively saying, as the market's falling, sell, and as the market goes up, buy. So just before the market perhaps has a major downturn, you're actually gearing up to maximum exposure within the fund. Now that's clearly that's risky for obvious reasons. That's what we've seen in 2000 to 2003. But if you do that in a more formulaic approach, then that technique's actually being marketed as CPPI, constant proportion portfolio insurance, effectively, which does exactly that. As the market falls, it takes out the market. As the market rises, it goes in. Now, I can't necessarily see, this is just a personal view, but I can't really see why you would expect that to work, why you think you can get some equity risk premium with effectively an ex-post trading mechanism, in the sense that you wait till the market falls and then you get out. Ideally, you want to be doing this ex-ante, taking a view and getting out of the market before it moves, but clearly that requires much more skill. I mean, CPPI effectively is trying to do option replication. So instead of actually going and buying put protection, say, on your equity portfolio, this will actually do effectively what's called delta hedging as the market falls. But I think there's some fundamental issues with that. That's not to say I'm advocating buying portfolio protection, either buying puts, because at the end of the day, if you're buying equities and you buy downside protection on those, you can't really be expecting to get paid for your equity exposure over the long term either. So we have some issues to think about, and the question is there an alternative? And I guess I'm here to say yes, we do believe there's an alternative, but it does involve an increased reliance on skill-based investing. Gad has already talked about stock picking. Stock picking is more expensive, and it will be, because you require a group of managers to know, for example, companies in detail. I thought it was interesting to discuss the hedge fund structure. Often we talk about long-short hedge funds, and effectively that should be pure alpha and should be basically a pure stock picking alpha source. But in fact, if you look at the universe of long-short equity funds, then you actually find that they have a typical beta to the market, certainly the numbers I've seen, of in excess of a half. So if you actually look at the universe of long-short funds and just put it on a graph against the equity market, it looks surprisingly like a slightly damped version of the equity market rather than something that should be uncorrelated from a long-short alpha perspective. So that additionally makes you think, well, what are you actually paying for when you have exposure to these funds? Because you're paying 2 and 20 effectively when the returns are being driven by a beta exposure. So it's actually potentially an expensive version of beta. Now, the beta management, that's really what we're talking about here. We want an equity risk premium. We want to earn that, but we're not willing to sit and hold that over the long term. So if we think that the markets are going to turn down for 3 years, we need someone that can get us out of that. But clearly, you have to have managers that you think can actually deliver that for you as well. That is something that we offer, but effectively that's the only way you're going to start. It's the only way you can really consider holding equities if you have these short-term volatility constraints, is to dynamically manage your exposure. Now, it may be that you can, at particular times, that there's not necessarily anything out there that represents what you would call structural beta for you to have access to, and you need to look at other ideas to get your returns. So you need to diversify away from market risk. So we've talked about diversified beta. In my mind, when I'm thinking of structural beta, it's effectively buy and hold. You expect to earn a risk premium over the long term for that. But there are also other types of market risks that you can use to diversify away from equities. And they can involve things like currency carry trades, where there's not necessarily a reason why you should get paid for taking that risk. It's just that you have a view and you think that you might get paid for it over your relevant timescale. But then we can also extend that to other markets. Effectively, it can be, you know, in essence, I suppose I think of dynamic management of market risk as effectively like a global macro hedge fund, where they'll be switching in and out of markets and taking macro plays as well as anything else, but on an absolute return basis. So we can also look at yield curve plays, leverage exposure to credit and mortgage-backed securities, which is quite an interesting one given what's gone on over the last year, but there are some interesting opportunities, and commodity exposure, which is something else we've heard about. So within our fund, I just thought I'd look at a couple of examples of trades that we've had on previously. One was going long Turkish lira. Now, effectively, the way this works is you look at the difference in interest rates between Turkey and the UK. That difference, when we're originally looking at the trade, was the order of 16%, which means you can actually buy Turkish lira in the forward market at a discount of 16%. Now, if the spot rate doesn't move over that period, then effectively you've made 16% if you're talking about holding this over a one-year horizon. However, the way this is priced is such that you would expect, it's effectively no arbitrage pricing, you would expect the Turkish lira to depreciate over that year by exactly 16% so that you can't take these kind of opportunities. However, that's not actually the case. So as long as you're happy to take a view on what the rate will actually do over that period, then you're simply earning this carry effectively over time. And what you can see from the top graph, effectively that's 6 years of data, is that although there's quite a lot of volatility in the exchange rate, is that it's effectively not really gone anywhere. And the chart at the bottom is a period over which we actually did look at it. Just I think around the time of the spike, we went long and we held that for I think around 6 months, and then got out when there was some political instability in Turkey and so on. So it just shows that if you can take a view, then there are some very interesting trades where you can actually get paid very well. But the difficulty is they can be quite scary because they're emerging markets currency trades, which people aren't so familiar with. So it's a high risk position, but we do actually expect to be very well rewarded for it. Another example, Japanese hedge interest rates. I'm going to talk a bit about swaps, the swap curve. Effectively, this trade is equivalent to buying overseas Japanese bonds and then hedging it back into sterling. So effectively, you get the yield on that bond, but hedging the yen back into sterling, it's another carry trade effectively, so you're getting, at the time you were getting a pickup of the order of 5%. The equivalent way of doing that through swaps is actually, because it's unfunded, you keep your money on deposit in the UK earning LIBOR, and then you entered into a swap. So originally when we entered into this swap agreement, swap rates, if you can see from the short end, the lower curve was actually around zero. So we were effectively paying 0% and being paid something like 2.5% back at the long end just for entering a swap. So we're earning LIBOR, and effectively we've just managed to create 2.5% carry effectively for nothing. So if you think that curve is stable and short-term rates weren't going to go very far and long-term rates weren't going to move that much, then you were simply going to get paid 2.5%. As it happens, short-term rates have increased. So on average from that trade, we're looking at a carry of an average of, say, 2%. But in fact, we think, the main exposure is that long-term interest rates go up. We don't think that'll happen. If anything, we think that the long-term rates will come down. And therefore, that seems like a very simple position, but it's something that's a bit more involved and a bit beyond what most investors may look at. So what's the risk profile of these funds? We've got Japanese duration there, FX, UK equity, and so on and so forth. This is what we term a waterfall diagram. Effectively, we look at each of the risks within the fund on an isolated basis and look at what we call the standalone contributions. So the Japanese yen position there is 2.2%, FX 1.6%, so on and so forth. Now that ignores diversification, so once you've added up all the blocks to the top, you're getting a figure of the order of 10%. And then that diversification block, that 5.5%, is the balancing item that takes you to the actual volatility in the fund, which is 4.4%. Now you can see that we have a very wide array of ideas in this fund, and when you do that, you can see a very, very significant benefit from diversification, and I suppose you have simple examples in your mind. You do expect that when equities fall, then fixed income will outperform, and hence there's a natural offset between, for example, your equity position and your Japanese yen. So you can actually find that some of these positions, for example, the Japanese duration position, if you take that out of the fund, the risk in the fund actually goes up because it's a great diversifier for equity. So in some sense, it feels a bit like a free bet, because if you think you'll actually get paid for it, it's a great diversifier against your equity position. So this effectively then we're advocating diversified beta, but also looking at other types of idea and managing your risks on a shorter time scale. Why has this not been adopted by with-profit funds? Well, there's marketing reasons. Treating customers fairly can be interpreted as meaning that you have as high an equity backing ratio as possible, but also that there are good ways and bad ways to lose money effectively. It's very familiar that you have a large exposure to equity and the larger the better, because you might get paid more in the long term. But if you suddenly tell someone that you have money in Turkish lira, it's not quite the same thing. And if you lose money from one rather than the other, there's a bit of a question mark raised about. I mean, it's familiarity, and in some sense, I guess most people wouldn't necessarily be competent to have a view on that. And that's part of the issue. Modelling reasons, life funds are not hedge funds. We need to optimise return per unit capital, not return per unit risk. And modelling some of these esoteric risks, Turkish lira, structured credit, is a lot more involved and requires a lot more work. And it's something that generally people aren't so familiar with. So that's just more onerous. Price reasons. The price of skill-based investing is higher. However, it is worth saying that dynamic management of beta can actually be fairly cheap as well, because you can move very large positions around using futures, for example, and I think that's a great benefit. You can have a relatively small team taking asset allocation decisions, and you can move your exposures around fairly fluidly. And just lastly, often the entity paying the fund management fee only benefits from the success of the strategy. I think that effectively comes back to shareholders again, saying that shareholders have an interest, but if the fund actually outperforms, how much of the extra return do they actually see from all of the infrastructure and everything else that has to go into doing something that's more complicated? So the chance for with-profit funds is they do want absolute returns, but they've limited capacity for risk, capital adequacy issues. This can be achieved by broadly being diversified, as we've already talked about, but really we're saying that all of the risks in your fund are managed deliberately, they're looked at every day, and we make sure that they're rewarded. The big challenge is to deliver this in a way that meets end client expectations. There's an education process that has to go into explain what you're really doing, and it has to be done at a reasonable cost as well, not sort of hedge fund costs necessarily, or more expensive than that, hedge fund of funds type costs. And the alternative is really a diluted, twitchy version of what we've had in the past, which is a CPPI-related management action style approach, which is which I think is less efficient anyway. So I think it's a very pertinent question at this time, given what the markets have done and the volatility. What is the best way to manage with profit funds and deal with the asset allocation problem? Thank you.
Thanks, Gareth and Brian. Does anybody have any questions? I've got a roving mic down here. So. In the second row.
Thanks, Gareth and Brian. Very interesting presentation. Just a question regarding diversification. Obviously, in both of your presentations, you've assumed there's one thing you haven't, you know, is there's certain levels of diversification we assumed in your modelling. How do you kind of manage, I suppose, basically kind of the tail risk, correlations at the tail? What kind of, do you use any scenario testing, and what kind of things would you look at to manage that?
Ooh, that's good. That's a very interesting subject, given the context of what pension funds suffered in the early part of this decade. When you look at much of the ALM work that was carried out in the early 90s, and you looked at the, let's say you did an ALM study in, I don't know, the end of 89, just before the markets completely collapsed, and you looked at the tail events as you saw them, you know, what, and the 95th percentile outcomes and the work, therefore the worst case scenarios. If you wind the clock forward and then to say 2003, 2004, and look at where the funding position actually turned out to be, it was way worse in most cases than even the worst case scenarios. And you might say, well, yeah, you know, it's a tough time for equity markets. Sure enough it was, but it wasn't a, it may have been a 1 in 20 event, something like that, but it's, when you look at the equity market in isolation, it certainly wasn't a 1 in 500 event. Well, bond yields fell and the liabilities went up. Yeah, that's absolutely true. But how, you know, but again, not to the extent that it would really be, you know, worse than a 1 in 20 event on the fixed income side. How on earth did the results of the ALM analysis prove to be so far off the mark in terms of the worst case scenario? And it's the point that you're hinting at there, which is, comes down to correlations. A lot of the modelling, in fact, most of the modelling assumes a constant correlation between the major asset classes. So a correlation of, let's say, 30% between equity and bond returns. So that when equities are falling, bonds are probably falling, bond yields are going up, pulling the liabilities down. The reality is that that correlation itself moves around. And in the early part of this decade, what we saw was exactly that, equity markets falling, bond yields falling, so bond prices rising, and negative correlation between equity and bond returns of the order of minus 0.3, minus 0.4 in some cases. How does one address that? So you address it most simply by having a variable correlation in all of this. The correlation itself fluctuates and is a very significant part of the overall risk equation. In practice, how we do it is to look at particular correlation scenarios. So we will look at scenarios where that correlation has turned negative for a period of time, but it's important not to overlook it.
Yeah, I suppose I don't really have too much more to add to that. Effectively, you do have to be fairly realistic about what you think your risk models are telling you and the assumptions that go into them. If I see a volatility measure for a fund, I don't really think that's a forward-looking estimate for the next 5 years. I think it's, effectively, I interpret that to be, given recent market volatility and the positions I have, on a similar day, what might I expect the volatility of the fund to be? But how long that will last is really a view that you have to take. You do have to stress correlations, and we would consider stress tests on the fund, effectively just saying, looking at adverse scenarios where we would observe a bad loss in the fund. But then effectively, the difficulty is at the end of the day, you still have to take a view. You can apply some stress tests, but then you still have to say, what probability is it that you think that will happen? Because you have to take risk in a fund, and at the end of the day, it's a case of looking at all the scenarios and taking a view on the probability of those, and you still may well get it wrong. So, yeah, that's probably all next.
More questions?
Right. I wonder if you could talk about the trade-off between doing something that is eminently sensible from an investment perspective, which it sounds like your fund is, and then actually trying to market that to, I mean, you may be talking about with profits, but to pension funds as well, who are used to, you know, kind of equities, good for high returns, bonds safe, and beyond. When you get beyond that conversation, it's quite difficult. And looking at how you divided up risk, talking about curve trades and duration trades, sounds like it's a difficult conversation to have.
Yes, it's a lot more involved. I suppose we've, as Gareth pointed out, that LDI is really improving over the last, well, it's coming to the fore, I guess, over the last few years. I was at an LDI conference last week in Amsterdam. It was LDI Europe. And the interesting thing is the thinking has very much evolved now to appreciating that in an LDI fund, there's a liability replicating portfolio and there's a return seeking portfolio. And it was surprising the number of talks that were actually covering diversified beta and talking about alternatives and everything else. And that was a real step change from the previous 2 years when I'd attended, when effectively LDI seemed to be about putting more money into bonds, which is something I was sort of being quite vocal about. It's difficult because I suppose that the barrier is also that perhaps you have to go through the consultants first. You have to speak to the consultants and they have to get comfortable with what you're doing, because to some degree, if the trustees are still struggling with understanding what swaps really are and what unfunded derivatives are, then they're going to have to increasingly delegate that responsibility, I think, to the consultants. So it's a big education exercise, but I think we are making progress. And just at that conference last week, I think it's there now in terms of diversified beta.
More questions? Okay. Well, just before we formally thank Gareth and Brian, just some dates for your diary. After quite a long Christmas break, we've got three meetings coming up in quite close succession. We have the 28th of February, we have the Action Group for Banking Working Party, and they're going to come along and talk through some new case studies, and that'll be a breakfast seminar again. And then on the 26th of March, we have our usual current topics roundup of the year. And that will be a joint meeting with FAS again. And that will be an evening, a start at 5:30 in here. And then we've just had confirmation that Otto Torreson, the CEO of Aegon, is going to come and speak to us. I think we're really lucky to get him. And he's coming on the 9th of April, and he'll talk about his findings from his recent review on generic financial advice. So I think that should be a popular one. Okay, so just to remind to say thank you all for coming along, and thanks to Gareth and Brian for a really interesting talk.